Environment on June the 4th. We will start with House Bill 3456. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3456. Ledger?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries, and I have with me Mr. Mark Morford with Soil Reed, who's chair of their environmental practice group. And he is also chair of the AOI cleanup committee, and he's very active in cleanup issues and cleanup projects and cleanup law generally. I also have a couple of handouts I'd like to pass out if I could. And you should also have some dash 4 amendments in front of you, which are all intents and purposes I've got in the original bill. This bill deals with cleanup, and that is cleanup of things that you might find if you own land, own a company. For example, you might find out that there was some creosote that's located in the soil, perhaps something that's done some years ago that contaminated the soil, as we are today. We're not talking here about illegal discharges. Certainly, if you have some type of a waste now and you discharge it and it gets in the soil, that's an illegal release, and that falls under RCRA laws and CERCLA laws, and then you're going to have to clean that up. So these are things that you find that are historical interest, where the contamination has been there for a while. They're not illegal discharges, and the people that find these things are not criminals. The people that own land and find out that in the past there's been a bad practice there, it was probably legal at the time. When you find out that you have some contaminated property, you have several options. There's several things can happen. The worst of which, the biggest of which, is a Superfund action that you've all heard about. And this is a federal action, sometimes sort of half delegated to the state. You need this for the really big cleanups. And these are things like, which we hope Portland Harbor will not become. But there are a lot of these scattered around the country, and these are fairly major cleanups under control of the federal government. You don't have a lot of flexibility in this. It's very laid out how you go through the process. The next level down is where you have DEQ issue an order to clean up. And there are quite a few of these around, and our bill, as I'll show you, does not affect their ability to order a cleanup. The next level down, really, is where you enter into what's called a voluntary cleanup with the DEQ. And it might be truly voluntary in that you come to the DEQ and say, I want to sign an agreement with you whereby there will be fairly close oversight of my cleanup, for whatever reason you may want to do that. And the protocol is long, it's cumbersome, it's very process-oriented, but it does take you through, ultimately, to a cleanup, one hopes. And it might be truly voluntary, or it might be what I call an Army-style voluntary cleanup, which is you either go in the cleanup program or we give you an order. Either case is good. It's a voluntary cleanup process. The next level down, which is very common, is to do what's called an independent cleanup program or an independent cleanup. And in Oregon, you can do an independent cleanup. You can get, and they're done all the time. You can go out, find out you have some contamination, and you can conduct your own cleanup. You can get it cleaned up, or you can mediate it in some way. There are various ways to do it. And you do not have to tell the DEQ about it. You don't have to come to them for approval. It doesn't go out to public notice. You can just do it. And a lot of these are being done. And then the bottom line, the bottom thing, of course, is to do nothing at all, which is what I don't like to do. What we're trying to deal with here is the area of independent cleanups. That is, cleanups that you do that you do not have to report to the DEQ. You can just do it and not tell anybody about it. Independent cleanups should be encouraged. We want people to do cleanups. It cleans up the environment, enhances the sale of the property. You may want to get it cleaned up as part of the sale if you have contamination. Enhances property values. And it's also the lowest cost of any cleanup because it has the least amount of oversight. So what we want to do is for people to do more independent cleanups. And ideally, we want them to come to the DEQ after they've done it, or maybe even while they're doing it, and say, am I doing this right? I would like a sign-off from you saying I've done the cleanup and I meet standards. And that's really the nub of it. How does somebody who does an independent cleanup and has a choice of going to DEQ and ask for a sign-off and review, how do you encourage them to do that? That's ideally what we want to have happen. So we want to encourage independent cleanup, and as part of that process, and really the nub of the bill, is how do you get an approval from DEQ that your cleanup meets standards? You get what's called a no further action letter. And there's nothing magical about a no further action letter. It could be called anything else you want to call it. But what it is, it's a stamp. It can be conditional. It can be loaded with conditions. A stamp from DEQ that says your site meets standards as they're outlined in the law and the rules. In the original bill, we had quite a bit of text about how you go, kind of front-end loading of the bill, how you go about qualifying for a no further action letter. And this generated quite a bit of controversy. So what we have done in the dashboard, and I'll take you through them quickly, is we've taken all that text out and we've simply replaced it with a paragraph that says the DEQ will develop a process, develop a program. So we're really leaving it up to the DEQ to develop the process through rulemaking and develop the program. And they've already started down that route a little bit, although there's nothing in statute that establishes it. This would be what establishes it. And I did have passed out to you the independent cleanup pathway, so this is already something that is sort of underway. What this bill would do is establish guidelines from the legislature, sort of a philosophy that the DEQ would implement through the rulemaking process. The other part of this bill deals with what happens when there is, and this is frequent, contention between the parties about what is adequate when it comes to a cleanup. And you might think that what would go on would be very objective and cut and dry science and engineering, but in fact, very often there are very, very lengthy technical disputes that will, in some cases, literally take years. And they revolve around extremely esoteric things, analysis of risk, risk pathways, how the rules are applied. And we've all heard about these things going on with Superfund sites at the national level, where people go for years and years and years and years and years before cleanup is actually done. There are enormous amounts of money spent before cleanup is actually done. And what we're finding in the independent cleanup issue is that a lot of people are willing to clean up on their own, but they are afraid to come to DEQ to get DEQ involved because they see themselves as stepping into essentially a swamp, you know, a tar pit. And they've heard horror stories, you know, and I don't know if we want to go into them, but they've heard horror stories that exist, that once you get into the cleanup program, it can take you years and years and years to get out, and it'll be years and years and years of essentially dispute and discussion not spent on cleanup. So people are afraid of that, so they're not coming to the DEQ to get a sign-off in any cases. And we don't think that's good. We would like people to feel free to come to the DEQ, and DEQ tell them you meet standards or you don't meet standards. And if you don't, then you've got to go home. And if you do, that's great. Get a sign-off. So what we did was we constructed a device that would help settle disputes. And we looked around at several models, and we found that in many states, many programs, even in Oregon, have what is essentially an appeals board to settle technical disputes. And this bill constructs an appeals board, a technical appeals board, an independent action review board, and it's on one page of the green sheet that I passed over for you. And we tried to construct it so it would be as objective and neutral as absolutely possible to settle disputes. And we've made some changes in the bill to try to encourage people not to use courts. One of the changes we made in the Dash 4 amendment are if you can't come to resolution with the DEQ on whether you should get a no further action letter or not, you can put a 30-day notice that you want to go to the appeals board mechanism. Under the Dash 4s, that 30 days can be extended indefinitely by agreement of both parties to have the parties go through mediation and negotiation. So we want some pressure to make people, instead of going to the appeals court, to try to settle their differences. There has to be something that will put pressure on both sides to get those issues settled, or they'll just go on forever like they are doing now. Assuming the parties can't come to an agreement under negotiation and mediation, then the appeals board is called in. The appeals board is made up of 5 members. They are selected by the governor in consultation with DEQ, the director. They are confirmed by the Senate. And the requirements are that they have 7 years' experience in their field. One of them might be an environmental engineer, a geologist, environmental attorney, risk assessor, and one other scientist chosen at large. But they would be selected by the governor and the DEQ director.
Mr. Chair?
Good morning.
You have to tell us the story about how you came up with the 7 years of experience. Where did that come from? Why 7 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we thought there's nothing magic about 7. We thought 7 years was long enough that they've been in the business a while. You know, they're technically competent. We thought that was sort of a minimum criteria.
Okay.
Nothing's magic about 7 other than it's a prime number. But the function of the board is to overview and see disputes. The only restrictions on who cannot be on the board is they cannot be employed by the DEQ or the EPA, which makes sense. But they could be employed by water resources, a university, a consultant, anybody else. There are provisions in the bill for conflict of interest, so if they're related to somebody where the appeal is taking place or something else like that, then they haven't gotten substitutes. We also put in the dashboard some improvements on the board, which is that they have to develop their own rules that involve a public process. Right now, when you do an independent cleanup, you can just do an independent cleanup and not tell the public about it at all. Under this process, if there's a dispute and it goes to the board will have a public process that will bring in the public on it. So we think that helps too. The board will have several options. The board can either agree with the DEQ, tell the company, DEQ's right, you know, we have to live with it. And that has some benefits. I think that will make consultants be extra careful when they do work that they know might get appealed to this expert board. And it's going to raise the level of professionalism. They might tell DEQ, we think you're out of line with your own rules and guidelines. They could do a combination. They could remand it back for further information. But they have broad authority to come to some type of conclusion. After they do that, either party can appeal the result to the Environmental Quality Commission. And the EQC is a lay board appointed by the governor. They oversee the DEQ. They hire the director. They give the DEQ policy. We tried to build in a lot of safeguards to make it as comfortable as possible for the agency. There are a couple of things I think that are important about having an expert in the board. One is, if I were the agency, I could think, well, what this is going to help the consultants do a better job. Because if consultants come in and their work is poor, it goes to the appeals board, and the appeals board kicks it back a couple of times. Rules will get around that consultant is not doing work that passes muster. And that's kind of a self-policing thing on the consultant. The other thing it does is if I'm talking to a member that wants to do a cleanup, and they're afraid to get into the cleanup program or afraid to approach the DEQ because they're afraid they're going to be involved in a morass that they cannot get out of, there will be no decision point, I can tell them there is a way out. There is a mechanism you can employ that will give you light at the end of the tunnel, the appeal board. If it's never used, that would be great. The appeal board will be funded by a fee structure set up by the Environmental Quality Commission, so businesses will pay to use the appeal board. They don't know how much it will cost. They'll have to do that through rulemaking. We are open to any other suggestions anyone may have on how to make this thing work right. But we feel that it's imperative that something be done so companies feel more comfortable coming in to get their cleanup handled. There are a couple of things that you'll probably hear a little later on in the hearing that I'm just going to touch on and then I'll be done. One is that the process is too administrative. Most of the bill, when you look at the bill, most of the bill is renumbering definitions or it is just the process itself. Like, you know, they get 20 days to do this, you get 40 days to do that, and they still forth get 70 days to do this. So that's laid out, so there's just no question about how it operates. I don't know if it's too administrative, but if you've ever been through a cleanup, or known someone who's gone through a cleanup, it just looks like breadcrumbs, you know, as far as administering the process goes. It'd be well worth it. You'll hear that maybe there was concern that this appeals board will run over the department and end up reversing all the department's decisions. Well, it's going to be appointed by the governor in consultation with the DEQ, and they can choose anyone they like from the agencies or the private sector. So, and it's very important to us that they choose good people. The worst thing that could happen would be to choose bad people for everybody. And it can also be overturned by the EQC. So if the director does not like the final result, you can appeal it to the EQC. So we think that will be relatively safe. You might hear that right now things are smooth and wonderful in the cleanup program. I can just tell you as a representative of a lot of businesses that they are not. I'm not going to come up with horror stories, but they're simply not. One is you'll hear that there are not real problems, but the DEQ has been doing dramatic things and all kinds of studies to fix what are not problems. And you'll probably hear about those too, and they wouldn't be doing those unless there were problems. One, you'll probably hear about that it's too late in the session to do such a bill with such major effects. Well, this just affects the independent cleanup program, and it only affects if you appeal and can't negotiate a different solution. And if this bill is too big to be at the time, then I, you know, probably schools and school funding and that sort of thing are hopeless. You'll hear that lots of sites are being cleaned up now, and that there's a huge backlog in the voluntary cleanup program. But when you have a monopoly, I don't know if a big backlog is a good indicator of good service. There's a telephone company, you know, who I will not talk about, but they're in big trouble because they have a huge backlog of people wanting service and order. I don't know if that's a good indicator that the service is running. If you don't have a monopoly and you have a back order, then it probably is. And I know there are lots of people out there that want to do cleanups that are not, or they're not reporting. One is Portland, if this passes, Portland Harbor will go Superfund. Well, at the last, I'm going to point out to you some text that ensures that this does not decrease the authority of the DEQ at all to issue orders, and this only applies to independent cleanups that you can do now anyway, and I'll tell the DEQ about it. If anything, this will improve the performance of both the consultants and the DEQ. You'll hear that maybe the board is unnecessary. Maybe it is. If it's unnecessary, then it won't be used in that case. One is it will draw DEQ resources away from the agency. So many people will go into the voluntary, into the independent cleanup program. Well, to get into the independent cleanup program, you're going to have to pay for the review. You're going to have to put the bill. The company's going to have to put the bill to do this, by fee structure. And frankly, I can't think of anything better for the state than to have so many cleanups underway, so many people coming to the DEQ to get cleanups done, that it swamps the agency. I think that would be a wonderful thing, and we could deal with that later, whatever happens with that. So that's really all I have on the bill, other than I would ask you to read on the green sheet. I got a question here. Oh, excuse me.
I'm on page 3, and I'm looking at line 20 to line 22. A person possessing the appropriate knowledge and experience may be appointed by the governor as a temporary board member to serve on the panel at the request of the chairperson of the board. Can you describe what instances that would be used in? And I'm curious about how this person gets confirmed and how long their tenure would be for and those kinds of things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I think I'll let Mark handle that.
This particular provision is in the section on board members having to recuse themselves because of conflict. And so it would be called upon if there were not enough board members in the standing board to serve, either because of board members having been recused or if they were just recused on the board. That's the purpose for it. And there's not a confirmation process associated with it. It is a temporary appointment. The tenure for board members is limited, and at least a temporary member could not serve any longer than until that position was up for a reappointment.
I'd like to hear one horror story.
Go ahead, John.
I think we might have one in the wing.
One in the wing. There's someone here.
Okay.
That's okay.
I'm not sure who would pay for the activities of the review board.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, that would be paid for by the petitioner, that is the person requesting the appeal, and that would be done according to a schedule of fees adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission. So the Environmental Quality Commission would have to pass rules establishing fees.
I just can't help but see this as another layer between industry and DEQ. How do you justify that? I guess is it that you need a buffer or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, I think that's a good question, and there's actually multiple pieces that I won't go through all of them. There's multiple pieces. One is there is no appeal mechanism right now, an independent cleanup. If you can't come to an agreement with the department, you've gone like discussing it for a year. It's sort of informal. What the department does is they get some of their managers together to talk about it, and then the appeal after that I think goes up to the manager, and after that I suppose it goes up a little higher in the department. So there's nothing that you can show a company to say if you get caught in a morass of decision making, here's a way out. And I think we need that. The other is there's terrific frustration in the regulated community of people that want to clean up, want to get the cleanup done and can't. And they feel that the biggest obstacle to getting the cleanup done is the process they go through. Not just the standards are fine. It's just getting resolution of technical issues. It goes on forever. And we think that if we have this board, that's a backstop where you could say, okay, I don't think we can come to agreement on this. Let's take it to the appeals board. The analogy I always use here is if you on your taxes, IRS, if you went to the IRS and the IRS says, well, we don't think you did your taxes right. You know, we have this, I know it's not happened to anybody on this, but we don't think your taxes right. We can stop this deduction. And you said, I really think I'm right, and I would like to confess this. I think I'm right. What are my appeals? What are my appeal options? And if they told you, well, we really don't have any, because if you contest this, what we'll do is we'll get a couple of other agents together to discuss it. And then if they don't agree, we'll get an IRS manager to look at it. That's the appeal mechanism we have. Or if they said, well, you can go to tax court. Now we can get a fair hearing. Now, one of those is cold comfort, and the other one would make you think, okay, I think I'm right. I'd like to get this resolved. And it offers hope to companies that will come into the program knowing they're not going to get trapped.
The measure applies to all cleanup, right? I have no problem for talking about independent cleanup of underground oil tanks, for instance, that I think perhaps if we moved in that direction in some areas, the public would be better served because we would actually incent people to take care of those. But in my instance, we're talking about sediment and in recent years, a big cleanup by DEQ at a former mill site, which is now, in cooperation with the city, which has now made it a marketable riverfront property. So I'm very interested in cleanup, but I'm not interested in taking away oversight. I actually am very concerned about that in this measure. It's not the Environmental Quality Commission a place where industry can go.
Representative Taylor, right, this only applies to what's called independent cleanup, and that is cleanup that can be done without DEQ oversight. That's all this applies to.
So if DEQ issues an order or an order, something like that, this does not apply. This does not apply to all cleanups. This just applies to ones done under independent cleanup. They would not even have to tell the DEQ they were doing the cleanup. And what's happening is companies are doing the cleanup and they're not coming to DEQ to ask for sign-off. This would result in more people coming to doing the cleanup and coming to DEQ for the sign-off. So this doesn't affect the things that you would be talking about. Pretty near.
Questions from the committee, Representative Merkman?
Could you clarify for us what types of contamination you're required to go to DEQ and on which types you can independently clean them up under current law?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Morford can handle that.
DEQ has a process for prioritizing sites. They rank from low, medium, or high based on preliminary information that they have about the site. This bill does not dictate which sites DEQ must or can put through independent cleanup. DEQ recently, just in the last month, has come out with this independent cleanup pathway, and they have limited that to the low and medium priority sites and have excluded from that the high priority sites, which they still believe require, in all instances, a higher level of oversight. So that's within DEQ's control, and that's their current approach to it.
And under this legislation, would that alter DEQ's ability to keep the higher priority sites out of the independent cleanup process?
No, it would not. Again, Section 2 gives DEQ pretty much complete discretion in how they establish the process and does not attempt to change the process that they've just put in place.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes,
follow-up. As I read through this, it seems to me it's focusing on the site itself, and the language at the end of Section 2 really emphasizes the achieved results. And I wanted to clarify the site itself versus the impact of the way one cleans up. And, for example, there are types of sites in which, as you clean them up, you really don't want to generate dust because the dust itself is going to spread toxins over a wide area. There are other types of toxic spills. You can clean it up very effectively with thorough scrubbing, but you're essentially washing the stuff into the river where it has a bad effect. I could envision lots of types of cleanups where I could come to DEQ after I've cleaned it up and so I'd look at the site under this independent, haven't I done a nice job? It's all cleaned up. But I'm concerned about not encouraging people to come before they clean it up, which is what the current system does, because the way you clean it up has a huge impact on the environment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the current status of the law and programs is that I can go out and do my independent cleanup without notifying DEQ, without involving them at all. And certainly one could create risk in doing the cleanup of the nature, some of the examples that you provide. Now, any cleanup that goes forward has to comply with all the laws that are in place intended to protect the air and the water. You can't just wash contamination into the river. You need a special permit for that discharge. The same is true for your air emissions. Under the cleanup pathway that DEQ has just put in place, and similarly under a prior version of the bill as we originally introduced it, the party doing the cleanup has a right to come to DEQ and request technical consultations and assistance, and DEQ is encouraging that. So that this cleanup program, this independent cleanup program, should involve the DEQ more in the independent cleanup than without this program, where companies are out doing exactly these kinds of cleanups without any involvement of the agency.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you for your time.
I'll be
back up here for some clarification. We did have a couple members in here on a particular bill that they were wanting to
your testimony on. I was going to close on this and let them finish their work. If we can get them back in here. Hold for a second, please.
Sure.
Oh, there they
are.
Diddy, all right. I might be able to call in here real quick. There's my other numbers already.
Good morning.
This is represented. I'm just waiting to see if I have a couple other members working on it too. Dan Mercer, come forward.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dan Mercer. I'm with Mercer Industries Incorporated of Portland, and we been in the manufacturing business in the area since 1926. An old family firm, and I'm one of the surviving members. Over the past 20 years, we've had essentially a problem with contaminated waste and so forth, which we've accumulated. We've reported all the sources and sites that we had. Basically, we're involved through the DEQ early on, and they took appropriate action to clean up most of them except for one. We had at least five fuel oil tanks we decommissioned and got no further action letters on. We had a acid finishing plant, which we had down on Nikolai Street in Portland, which we decommissioned, got a no further action letter on. We have one of those left, which are basically is in the independent stage of being decommissioned at the present time. The one that gave us a problem was basically we had a very small wood treating plant, which involved the pentachlorophenol at Beaverton. And in this particular instance, for those of you who don't know what pentachlorophenol is, why it's a wood treating process, which is preventative for termites and so forth. This is a very small tank which we treated the wood sills on wood windows and so forth. And we stopped using that tank in approximately 1982, reported to the DEQ, and collected cleanup operations in 1985, which lasted till 1989, at which time we were given a no further action letter on this particular facility by Mr. Clinton of the DEQ and his constituent, Mr. Wood. All was peaceful and quiet for the next 5 years, and in December of 1994, we received a letter from the DEQ advising us that they had rescinded our no further action letter and that we should basically take the necessary steps to clean up the facility. After that occurred, we spent 6 months investigating and recommendations of the DEQ joined the voluntary cleanup program, and we employed two consulting firms in the environmental agency to essentially investigate our site and work with the DEQ. We had many meetings, and as a kind of an assessment of the amount of time and effort on this thing is we have a file with over 5,000 documents which we have accumulated on this particular problem and several others which we have had. It's required an immense amount of time and a very substantial amount of money.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask about the the situation in which your no further action letter was rescinded. Was it because of the pent up storage? Was there a leak? Or
basically, what they advised us was that the original investigation was incomplete, and that the criteria by which the judgment had been made had now been upgraded, and therefore we were to cleanup activities and cleanup. After about a year and a half of work with the voluntary cleanup program, we decided or came to the conclusion that we were getting nowhere. And we had numerous meetings. It was quite expensive. We paid the fees, due, required, and so forth. We employed two consultants, and both of these consultants wrote us letters and said that they did not think that we had any problem, in which we had a environmental problem at all. And as a result of that, why we did resign from the voluntary cleanup program, and while we are continuing to monitor the site ourselves and have a consultant monitoring the site, why we have literally done nothing. The independent monitoring service that we have now basically shows that our groundwater level of contamination has decreased about almost 40% in the last 4 years. And that this is evidently a self-cleansing proposition. And their letters essentially say that we present no risk of endangerment, which is the quotation mark, to the people that work on the site, nor to the surrounding area or to the groundwater in the area. I might mention to give you the scope of the thing. We own 22 acres, 226,000 square feet of buildings, employ 200 people at
base. What site is that, Mr. Mercer?
This is our major plant site at 617 and Denny Road, which is immediately north of Washington Square.
And where that is?
We are very supportive of this bill. I think Mr. Ledger gave an excellent explanation of the situation. I think it would contribute substantially to improvement of relations in this particular area, and also bearing some of these problems that fundamentally are not of any consequence.
Think other landowners, industrial owners, would be more apt to be part of a program like this if we had this process implemented?
I think it would provide an incentive to do that, just that.
Other questions? Trustee Morgan.
If this process had been available to you, would you have taken advantage of it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mercer, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Okay, let's close the work session on House Bill 3456 temporarily. We'll open Senate Bill 882. I think Representative King has some amendments that he wants to talk about here.
For the record, Al King, District 44, and you've already received my five amendments, and where we left off, I believe, was you wanted to verify that Senator Tarnow also felt comfortable with my amendment to his bill. Also, I had tried to accomplish, in addition to being able to provide an option for homeless, using your Inside Urban Growth Boundary, a consideration that it might be an option for target labor on farms, for a housing option, that in order to be within the enabling clause of this legislation would not fit. That part was about, and if that's to be accomplished, that would be the next legislative session. It's my understanding that Senator Tarnow does have some six recommendations, which have not impacted my part of the bill, which was Section 5 and afterwards. So I'm coming back to verify that Senator Tarnow was here this morning, and that I are both comfortable with this and going forward.
Chair, members of the committee, Vaughn Ebert for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With respect to the Dash 6 Amendment, they are with respect to Representative King's provision for transitional housing accommodations inside urban growth boundaries. They are the same as the Dash 5. The Dash 6s, we needed to do some technical clarifications between the 5s and the 6s, which I worked with Mr. Tarno on. Essentially, what we're doing in the Dash 6s is allowing in private campgrounds yurts for overnight camping. It will be the county that determines that yurts are appropriate in the private campground. There is a limitation on the number of yurts allowed within the campground so that it's in balance with the other types of camping opportunities. There is also a provision that the county may come to the Land Conservation and Development Commission and request an increase in that number for some or all of the campgrounds in their particular county if they can show it will not interfere with adjacent farm and forest practices. There also provides a definition of yurt to ensure that they are like those in state parks. They're not on a permanent foundation. There's no plumbing, sewage, or internal cooking hookups. And this would, this language would ensure that the yurts are authorized within private campgrounds in both farm, forest, and mixed farm forest zones. With that, I can answer any other questions.
President Cruz, thank you. From your agency's perspective, the bill as it came to us from the Senate, is it okay? Did it still have the original 882 at the past point?
Chair Welch, Representative Cruz, no, we were in opposition to the bill as it came from the Senate. We felt the language was too broad because it spoke generally to private parks having yurts for accommodations as well as other related structures. Private parks not being defined in the statute runs the gamut from amusement parks to paintball parks to a wide range of things that yurts and accommodations would have been inappropriate in conjunction with. We felt that what the intent of the bill originally was that to simply authorize it in private campgrounds, yurts just like they are available in public state park campgrounds. So we felt limiting it that way was the appropriate way to go.
Okay, and we have some early amendments that address that before we got into all this other stuff. Actually, the FPD's specific concerns before we started doing all this other stuff.
Dash 2.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe those were the Dash 3.
Dash 3.
And Dash 3 were the first rendition of Representative King's amendment.
So it was the Dash 3 that the agreement.
We might have had the Dash 1s, and then Representative Cruz was Dash 2s, and then I think they got merged into the Dash 3s, and then the Dash 4s came out that dealt with farm labor camps. And we went to the Dash 5, finding we needed a couple last-minute technical cleanups, and that's why we're at Dash 6.
Okay. I guess, Mr. Chair, my point was that there was, way back when, an amendment specifically to address your concerns with the original 882.
That's correct, Representative Cruz. The Dash 6s are essentially the same thing, but as there's always more time, you refine the language and get any ambiguities removed.
So the Dash 6s speak to your concerns with the original bill, or do they also include Representative King's amendments to the bill? In other words, if we wanted to address GLCD's concerns with Senate Bill 882, the Dash 6s do that. And if we wanted to address Representative King's language, we'd have to also do the Dash 5s, or everything in the 6s. So we do not have a set of amendments, because you have said that if the dash ones addressed your concerns with the original bill, but there has been some more modification. We do not have a set of amendments before us that specifically address all of your concerns with the original bill, then.
Farewell, Representative Cruz. The dash six amendments cover all our concerns as well as cover Representative King's amendments. They're in one amendment. If you wanted to split those, you'd either have to do it by motion or get a redraft to split them, because there is no earlier version that completely or correctly covers our concerns.
That was what I was trying to make. So even though the dash ones were basically an attempt to address your concerns with the original bill, they didn't go. You have since then discovered some other modifications.
There were some drafting errors in the earlier version, and so we've gotten that fixed. So we're perfectly comfortable with the dash six.
Mr. Chair.
We do have Chris Crane here from LC to talk to us about this. Chris, you want to go? If you have any questions for Chris, you can hear our request. You can close session.
Did you hear my and my confusion.
That's why he magically appeared.
Very well, thanks. I was listening on the television, and the dash pictures do include the proposals from the department and Representative Cruz's proposal. So all the
we look on.
Oh, and for the record, I'm
just saying, we realize that.
But for the record, I would also like to say there were no errors in the earlier amendment. We just looked at it and thought further refinements would be useful.
That's correct. We're not here. Bad choice of words.
Bad choice of words.
Yeah. So you know, if we wanted to have a separate Representative Keyes amendment and the corrections that the department wanted with the original 882 as it came from the Senate, we would have to have another set of amendments.
Representative Cruz, that's correct. I know my assessment, none of the previous amendments were in. There were prior amendments that split out the two proposals, but none of them, I would think, were in a final form for adoption. So if you wanted to split them out, you would need two more amendments, one for each.
Other questions here?
Thank you. I just want to be clear about the part that says the campground owner may provide these permanent, which I assume would be more permanent structures, the kitchen and the other facilities that would be required by families in this situation, and those would not hopefully be impermanent structures, but that's because they're already in allowable zones, that is not a problem.
I think you're addressing me, and I think that you're addressing the section six, and that it would be the yurts for homeless would not need to be permanently attached to any kind of foundation, and they can be removed in one and taken and re-set up in another location in one day.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Really,
sure.
One hope over for a little bit.
I guess there is a work session. I tell you, committee, what my concern is. We have combined apples and oranges here, in my opinion, and Representative King's proposed amendments to this were a specific separate bill that came before agency performance, and based on merit did not make it through that process, and now he's trying to add it to a bill here that I personally think is addressing a separate issue, and which is why I was asking about how we separate out the different components here, because I would like to, in the original bill that had to do with parks, I would like to make sure that DOCD's concerns are addressed in a set of amendments to make sure that that bill has been moved through. I think the yurts for homeless is a whole separate issue that needs to be addressed as a whole separate issue. So I would be disinclined to move the combination of the two.
I would just offer that we do this all the time. And I am more appealed by the idea of yurts for homeless needs than I am by the other part of the issue. And so for me, it's important to leave them together.
Sure. The challenge of dealing with homeless families or transitional homeless families in urban areas is pretty tough. We have a large population living in cars, and we have a large population living on streets. Often agencies are in a situation where conventional housing is ideal, but also extraordinarily expensive compared to other alternatives. There are cases where cities and counties have even chosen to just say, well folks, you can camp here. We won't give you too hard a time. We just hope the weather doesn't get too cold before we can figure out a solution. And this proposal by Representative King does provide an additional avenue. It hasn't really been tested, and I don't know if a county or city will choose to adopt it. The challenge is to find space that's also near to the services that homeless people need. There's lots of questions that would be addressed at the local level, but it does provide a tool to experiment with in tackling a very, very difficult problem. And I think it's valuable for us to give the opportunity for this to be experimented with, and I would certainly support keeping these elements together and sending this bill forward.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to get someone back up from Land Conservation and Development Department so we could ask them a few questions? Mm-hmm. It would be
fun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, if you were to look at the situation from the point of view of a city, without passing Representative King's amendments to the bills, would they be able to use some kind of alternate structures within the cities?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morgan, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's my understanding that the cities would not be able to establish camps for the homeless using the kind of yurts that are described in this bill. And I also am a little fuzzy on this. My understanding is it has more to do with building codes than zoning codes. So what this bill simply does is offer that option to the city or county want to set up a camp and find that it's prohibitive to build permanent structures. They would have a second option here, something that would be a little more affordable for these homeless camps. It would be a yurt, kitchen facilities, bathroom facilities, and the like.
May I have a follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair?
Yes.
So the obstacle then is that the building code doesn't specify that yurts are an allowable type of construction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's my understanding. There is someone here, I believe, from building codes who could probably address this better than I as to why building codes would prohibit these days.
For the record, my name is Patrick Lewis with the State Building Codes Division. Through the chair, to Representative Morgan, the yurts that we have today do not
do not meet the building code for this particular use within the city. It only through these changes in the law would be, we be allowed to create a standard specifically for these type of structures to be used in this way. And we would not be allowed to use it under our current laws and codes.
So the already permitted would be things like mobile homes and travel trailers. Those would be already permitted by the building code?
Manufactured homes would be permitted for residential use. Travel trailers for residential use would not without this bill. It basically gives us the authority to allow these type of structures, recreational structures, be used for this purpose, where right now the law does not permit.
I have an additional question. So would Representative King's amendments then limit the use of yurts only to this particular use, or would anyone in the city be at that point permitted to put a yurt wherever they wanted to put one?
Now, through the chair to Representative Morgan, no one would be allowed to put them just anywhere. It would restrict them to this use only as the transitional housing for this purpose. The only other place they would be allowed under this law would be in recreation camps that were like they're being used now in state parks for recreational use. But they would not be, it would not automatically permit them for residential use throughout the city.
Okay. And may I have one more? In your opinion, is the description of yurts in here sufficient to meet the needs of the building department in their ability to define what these things are?
Through the chair to Representative Morgan. We would need to write some administrative rules to fill in some of the gaps that are not discussed in this bill. Right now, we do not have a standard written. The only standard we have written would be the 22-family dwelling code, which yurts cannot meet. And so we would have to write a standard specifically for these type of structures for them to meet that had some safety requirements in them for the temporary use in the way that they're going to be used. And that's what this bill does, is create the authority for us to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if I could just add one thing. I'm not sure you realize that there are really two yurt types defined under this bill. The yurt that would be for the temporary housing for homeless inside UGBs is a more intensive structure authorizing something that looks more like a permanent living arrangement with bathrooms and kitchens. The yurt that is defined for as an allowed use for the private public campgrounds outside UGBs is for temporary camping facilities without those. There are two definitions.
Other questions? President Martin.
Mr. Chair, are we in a work session now?
We are in a work session at this moment.
Colleagues, I would like to move the Sixth Amendment to 3456.
Representative Merkley would like to move the Dash Sixth Amendment to
Senate Bill 882.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
A number of stories from my past are coming back to me. One is when I was at Habitat and a family came to my door. A woman, she had her daughter in a shopping basket. Her husband was diabetic. He was very close to needing medical attention. And she said basically they had been wheeling their cart around the city trying to find a shelter that would accommodate the family, and that they were determined that they would stick together. And those of you who have worked with homeless know that many times there are not shelters for families, and the shelters separate them into men and women. And some won't take kids because of the dangers inherent. But one of the features of this bill that's interesting to me and that may be intriguing to some entities around the state is that when you have a yurt-type structure, it provides privacy and safety, which are two things very hard to come by in homeless shelters, that can accommodate and enable a family unit to perhaps stay together. And often the breakup through shelters is a path through which families become disengaged. I don't know, and I'm also thinking about a transitional shelter that was run by Human Solutions, which is another group I work for, that had lots and lots of problems because it was essentially a converted hotel in which everybody was running over the top of everyone else, and there were lots of conflicts. As you realize, homeless families are people very much on the edge. There's many aspects of the concept of yurts that are interesting to be explored in the context of dealing with transitional homeless families. One is privacy, one is safety, one is keeping families together. There's also a number of challenges, and this bill gives the opportunity, the framework, for a county to wrestle with the pros and cons and determine whether or not they want to experiment with this strategy. I think it's an interesting strategy that our current building codes prohibit, and let's open this door to this experimentation by cities and counties.
Further discussion?
Having said all that, I think I think we're way far in on this stuff myself. I am not to the point of thinking that a solution to the homeless problem is setting up in cities and in our urban areas, and that's exactly what this is doing. I just don't, it's in California a few years ago, they thought they'd done something wonderful for the homeless when they provided them all with their own shopping carts. And, I'm thinking, that's not a solution, I mean, we aren't dealing with real solutions here. And to think that we can do something warm and fuzzy like this and think we've actually solved the problem, I think is somewhat erroneous. I mean, if we are having problems now with using older apartment buildings and still having privacy issues and people running over people, you're going to be better off in a tent. I don't see how that works. So, is this too technical something we're studying? I think so. I just think it's a little premature on actually doing something here. So I will go
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I respectfully disagree with my good colleague from Alberta. I know it comes as a surprise to all of us. I don't think that anybody's claiming that this is a solution to the whole problem. I think what we often see in this body is small steps to try to get at a bigger problem. And while I said I don't think this is the solution to the homeless problem, I do think that this gives communities an option that they don't currently have. I don't think that we're going to see tent cities in Portland. I mean, I can't think that the city government there would allow that, but I do see this allowing them the opportunity to use this if necessary. I mean, we passed a bill, we just testified over in the Senate, to allow local communities to give tax incentives for continuing properties in low-income housing, and I think that this isn't just another tool to use. Last year, we had a big crisis in Portland when we were transitioning between homeless shelters, and we had a temporary structure put up. It wasn't a solution to the problem, but it was something that they were able to use for a short time to fix the problem so that people could have a roof over their heads. And I think I am supporting the DASH amendment.
Other discussion?
I'd just like to say that having served for quite a while on the board at the homeless shelter, there are many times when homeless persons are housed in our state parks by the Salvation Army or other agencies that help people in distress. And in our state park out of Fort Stevens, we have a little yurt camp of 7, and then we have 3 or 4 more. They keep adding them, and I've stayed in them. They're quite different from a tent. They allow bunk beds and a futon that makes into a bed, and actually much more comfortable for a family than a tent. This kind of housing is being used, but very poor, not enough of it. So I think it will just provide a resource for those agencies that are already seeking to help people who are in this situation. It will be a limited time. Sure, it isn't a long-term answer, but it may be a part of the answer, and I concur that it's an important part. It's better than people sleeping in their cars that far.
Other questions, concerns?
Mr. Chairman, I would concur with some of the comments of my colleagues, and I'd also point out to the committee that the principal sponsor or the person that asked for the bill to be originally drafted, Senator Tano, has not objected to Representative Cheney's amendments before this committee. And so I'll be supporting this amendment.
I would also point out that Senator Tano would not object to his original bill.
That is true. I know. Okay. Thank you very much. No more questions for you. And yeah, that's sanity. Motion before us, Senate Bill 882, the -6 amendment. And I'll have the clerk please call the vote.
Is that approved?
No.
Excuse.
Chair Welch? Aye. Representative Janella?
Aye.
Representative Corey? Aye. Representative Merkley? Aye. Representative Morgan? No. Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Chair Welch?
Chair Welch
is an aye. Having a required number of votes, and Bill, the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 82 are passed.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I move Senate Bill 882 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Trustee Merkley moves Senate Bill 882 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative
Jackson. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Chair Welch. Chair Welch is aye. Required number of votes, Senate Bill 882 passed the floor with due pass recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 882, and we read the carrier. We will have
King
see the carrier. And we will reopen a work session on House Bill 3456. Langdon Marsh and Paul Lyman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Langdon Marsh, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me is Paul Simon, the manager of our cleanup program. And what Paul is giving to you for your consideration this morning, a couple of handouts. One is some testimony that I have submitted before for the record, and I hope you will thank me for not reading it today. The other is a handout that looks like this. It talks somewhat about our cleanup program in Oregon. And the third is a map of the voluntary cleanup program sites that are currently underway. And what I'd like to do is for a few minutes talk about the purpose of the cleanup program, a little bit about the voluntary cleanup program, and give an example, finally, of how we, why we believe that this bill, 3456, would not be consistent with the purposes of the cleanup program. First of all, the fundamental reason we have a cleanup program in Oregon is to protect the people, fish, and water. And on the handout, you'll see in the lower right-hand corner some examples of why we, or the kinds of cleanups that have occurred as a result of our efforts over the past number of years, basically to protect the public health and the environment. In the 1995 session, there was a very close consideration of this program, and some fundamental changes were written into law, which we are now endeavoring to carry out. The law placed a fundamental importance on protection of groundwater, and one of the ways it did that was to assure that so-called hotspots of contamination, in other words, areas of more intense concentration of contaminants, would be addressed by treatment, by preference for treatment, and not simply by providing some kind of protective level, such as paving it over or providing a deed restriction or something like that. So there was a clear preference. There is a clear preference in the law to do that. On the other hand, where there aren't hotspots, there is an ability for the agency to provide protection through approval of better than treatment options. The hotspots that can occur in soils or in groundwater or in sediments, and under the present law, we are looking at each of those in an effort to assure that the public, fish, and water are adequately protected. Now, you heard earlier that I would say, or someone would say, that the cleanup program has been successful. I don't want to dwell on that because I agree that while it has been successful, there is always room for improvement. One of the values we have at the Department of Environmental Quality is continuous improvement, as any business or other organization ought to have as its objective. And so we are very much open, as I'll mention later, to consideration of improvement of this program. But the map that you see there shows you that as of today, there are 267 sites around the state that have cleanups underway, and 182 that have been completed. So I think one of the reasons I wanted to put this before you is to demonstrate that while there have been and sometimes are claims of delays in the cleanup program, that a number of sites do get through. 73 alone last year, which was a record number for us. And there are around 300 underway, as this shows. And as my testimony indicates, we're getting double the number of sites into the program every month, voluntary cleanup. There is an increasing interest in having us look at contaminated sites around the state. One of the things that the debate around the 1995 legislation revealed to us is, in fact, that there was a substantial concern in the business community, people who were caught up in the voluntary cleanup program and felt that they couldn't find a way out, or at least that there were substantial time delays in addressing their sites. And we have taken that very much into consideration in adopting changes to how the program operates, so that as of today, in one sample we did, what we have done is to make agreements with site owners that in order to keep up with their business plans, that we will impose upon ourselves timetables or timelines, deadlines for getting back to them so that they can meet their financial and other business commitments. And, you know, one survey we did indicated that we were able to meet or better those timelines in about 85% of the cases. So the program has changed in its response to the business community over the last 4 years. Let me talk now a little bit about the bill and then give you an example of why we think it's unnecessary and would result in less protection to people, fish, and water. One of the major purposes of House Bill 3456, I believe, is to change the manner in which the department gives no further action letters. Those are the letters saying essentially that the site has is protective and is cleaned up to an acceptable degree. To change that from the current situation where we look at the site comprehensively and see if there are things that can be done to assure protection of people, fish, and water, to one where potentially the decision as to the level of cleanup is primarily, and in many cases, finally, left in the hands of the site owner. The example that's attached to your testimony talks about a site where hazardous substances have been released. Let's just say the Willamette River, it could be any river. Let's suppose that there is contamination of soils, groundwater, and sediments in the adjoining portion of the river. Now, under the current law, as this example indicates, the legislature has asked us, and I think the public has come to expect, that we will, in making a determination whether the cleanup is proposed by somebody for an independent review, or an independent cleanup is proposed for review and no further action by us, will ask and answer various questions. What substances have been released? Where will they travel? In other words, will they go beyond the site boundary? What are the risks to humans and the environment? And what are impacts to groundwater and the river and sediments? And what options are there to clean up the problem? We also, of course, ask the community for some input in the protective levels that will be established for the site. Under the bill that's submitted, including the amendments, we are concerned that these questions could not be properly asked and answered in most cases. For example, if the property owner were to submit an application for no further action letter that simply had a deed restriction in it saying nobody was going to use the groundwater on that site, or simply paved over the area with asphalt and indicated that that was protective for people who would be using the site and gave us no further information under this bill, we would be, in effect, required to approve or to issue a no further action letter, because if we ask for more information about underlying groundwater, the potential for hotspots, migration of groundwater to other sites, off-site of the a person's property, or sediments in the river, the applicant for the no further action letter could appeal that request, in effect, under the standards that are proposed under this Section 2 of this bill, we would have to okay that request because it's it would be protected in the very narrow sense.
Mr. Chair?
So, yes, sir.
Can I ask you a quick question on that point? Mr. Marsh, are you talking about the Dash 4 amendment to the bill?
Representative Welsh, Representative Kikori, yes.
Okay. It's my understanding from the Dash 4 amendments in Section 2 that it allows DEQ to establish the process and then to write the rules on how this cleanup process would work so that you could address concerns like that where you would not be giving a no further action letter to somebody who just merely paved over a hot spot. That's my understanding. Do you have a different understanding?
Representative Welch, Representative Lafori. Yes, because of the language in the last sentence of Section 2, it takes away from the department, even if we were to have a rulemaking ability, or even if the appeals section were to give us more authority than it does now, that language would still not allow us to consider, for example, the hotspot provisions and requirements of the existing law. So if we were to ask for more information to determine if there was a hotspot and that information was not forthcoming, our concern is that this law would make us have to issue the no further action letter. And then at some further point down the road, somebody lending on the property or somebody digging a well and it without the property restriction or a well on an adjoining property not subject to a deed restriction could in fact be pulling up contaminated water and either not be able to use the property or in the worst case use it for drinking water for some period of time.
A follow-up question?
Follow-up.
As somebody who is new to this issue, can you explain to me what in that last sentence in Section 2 tells you that you wouldn't be able to do this? Because I'm not clear.
Well, basically, under Section 2, under that language, the problem is that if there were, say, a paving or some other cap that simply sealed off the surface of the site from human contact, let's say, with the soil, that there was extensive other contamination of groundwater, for example, and there might be a substantial hot spot in the groundwater, that the standard here of effectiveness, results-oriented, results achieved, for example, would not cover the or not include the hotspot protection under current law, because that's a standalone provision under the law. We would have to find that it was effective in terms of what it did, which was to protect human contact with the soil, but not allow us to go further than that.
Mr. Chair.
I've got a question here. Representative Cruz.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding your problem with this also. As I read it, the protectiveness is in there. And as I read it, basically, if you boil it down into English, what that sentence says is that if the independent action actually achieves desirable results, the department can't disallow that simply because it doesn't comply with process. Because it's still talking about protectiveness, effectiveness, and reliability. And it says that you cannot base it simply because they haven't jumped through these hoops. It's talking about actual results. And what's wrong with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I absolutely agree that what we ought to be after in all cases is results. And the question, and environmental results that are protective and adequate. What is at issue here is which results and how far the results go. In the case that I mentioned, we would be able to find under this language and under the appeal process that the cap would be protective and would achieve results. The results that would be achieved would be the protection of people from contact with the soil in that example. However, if the larger problem were the potential for migration of a hotspot in the groundwater to other sites where people might potentially use that water, as we read this bill, it would preclude us from asking or getting information about that and from dealing with it. And I'm not saying that in every case it would be necessary to deal, you know, with a huge cleanup of that site. It may very well be that after looking at the other issues and looking at the risks involved, we would determine that, you know, especially if it was a lower medium priority site, tapping was perfectly adequate, perfectly cost-effective, it did achieve the right results, and that further cleanup could be deferred until some other time when there was another property transaction or another change in use. So what I'm saying doesn't necessarily mean that we just want more process and more cleanup, but we do want at least a minimum amount of analysis to see whether there could be something cost-effectively done about the rest of the contamination on the site, even if the cast in this case were protected in the narrow sense.
But you're writing the rules here. You know, your rules are not going to take into consideration translocation of hotspots to groundwater. I mean, aren't your rules going to cover these things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we read the last sentence there in Section 2 to be a legislative directive to change the philosophy of the cleanup program, at least for the independent portion of the cleanup program, from one that looked at the current issues, including hotspots, to one where the purpose is to achieve or to have us issue no further action letters on commercial cleanup. Now, again, I think that is often the case. We do issue no further action letters for partial cleanup on independent actions, but always having looked at the other possible sources of contamination. So while you're absolutely correct, Representative Cruz, that there would be rulemaking authority, our concern is that this language would control that rulemaking authority, and we would not be able to, in effect, bring the hotspot issue back in.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Martin.
Well, as I read the sentence, it's can be interpreted a variety of ways. The word emphasize, for example, doesn't say shall preclude, shall only address the results achieved or preclude other considerations. It seems to me maybe it's possible to work with the sponsors of the bill to address your concerns, to clarify this language so that we can go forward and have a discussion that's not based simply upon potential interpretations of this language. Am I reading you correctly that such a clarification might address your concerns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, this goes back, I think, to the issue that I raised in my testimony about the need for a bill in the first place. I believe, as I said earlier, that there are improvements that can be made and should perhaps what can be made in the program, including independence. I do not think, however, that we have the correct factual premise on which to debate legislation that changes the rules and the referees of the game as substantially as this does. I do think that the sponsors of the proponents of the bill have raised some fundamental questions about the relationship between the department's program and some members of the affected community. As I said, there are a lot of people who come forward to do these cleanups. There are undoubtedly people who are hanging back, concerned about the horror stories that they have heard, many of which are long in the past, and want to see some change in the program. I guess my response to that would be, since we have just undertaken a formal independent pathway for the cleanup program, let's take the next period of time to look at some of those issues, find out what they are. I am very open to establishing a mediation process, for example, to deal with the kinds of issues as Mr. Mercer brought up, for example. I think if we had had a mediation process in place, and I'm not sure that that was an independent cleanup, by the way, but if, even if it weren't, if we had had a mediation process in place, I think we could have dealt with some of the basically fundamental disagreements between his consultants and the department in a more satisfactory way. So I think there are things we can study, and I think there are things we can do in terms of putting in place some mediation process, perhaps some peer review, independent peer review of some of the independent cleanups, to see if we can learn some things that would make us able to make it a better program. This, as I said, however the language is basically setting a new standard that could affect the way we protect people fish and water.
I guess just to follow up, I'm not completely satisfied because at first you've been addressing this particular section in this particular sentence, and it seems like there's certainly the ability to address that sentence. And I appreciate your expanding your comment into the broader point that we have a new independent cleanup process in place, and you want to give that a try before establishment like this, and you are open to a mediation process as well at this point in time.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Marsh, I think we have something that's open now within this field under Section 4 that you didn't have before, and that is under Sub 4. And that is what they have described as the off-ramp for a mediation, negotiation or mediation. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, I have not had a chance to review more than the first page of the Bass Four Amendment. Can you take that?
Section 2, Section 4, Sub 4, and be on page 4, on line 19, and through that whole section there. You're allowing
right here. Thank you, Mr.
One to facilitate negotiation or mediation.
That was the change that Mr. Ledger referred to.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree that this that would make more people amenable to doing mediation if this bill were to be in place. I guess my concern is with the fundamental issue of whether we're going to be as environmentally protective under this bill as we are under current law, and it gets back to the question of what are you going to mediate, which results, partial results, or more complete results.
Well, it looks to be a little more user-friendly, and with this opportunity here for negotiation mediation, as you've been talking about by the department, that comes your process and your rules take a precedence here until finally then there isn't resolution or an agreement and it's appealed to the second coal field for it. And that comes down quite a ways in the process, seems like to me. Well, I think it encourages involvement where there may not be involvement today.
Mr. Chair, I agree that there is a need for us to find out what it is that makes people, some people, not all people obviously, but some people reluctant to come into our process. And I think that if we were to institute a fair mediation process, and I'm certainly willing to talk about how that would be structured, how independent it would be and so forth. I guess my preference would be let's try that without legislating at this point and do some of the other things or find out some of the other issues that people have who have not been willing to come forward. And I think, some kind of blind study might be able to elucidate that for us. I'd be certainly willing to do that or have it done. Then I think we'd be in a better position to see if on the elaborate appeals process, which would have some differential, would be necessary for us to do. I guess I would draw a distinction between the other appeals processes that are in place around the country for things like taxpayers and RLUIPA and so forth, in that those processes are put in place clearly to protect the individual and individual property rights. In this case, what we're talking about are public interests in protection of human health, fish and water. And I think that puts a different cast of the type of independent review that you
have. And there's not property rights involved in this?
Mr. Chair, there certainly are, but they're not. It's a balance of property rights and of public health and ecological rights, if you will. And I think that, you know, the objective of this program is clearly to protect people, fish, and water while promoting economic redevelopment in a cost-effective way. And I think, you know, where the disconnect has been, I believe, over the past few years with some of the potential participants in this program is that they don't see that as a reasonable balance. And I think we by establishing the independent pathway, by being open to, you know, trying to see what these issues are, by attempting the mediation process over the next 2 years, I think we can keep learning about how to make that balance between protectiveness, environmental results, cost effectiveness, and economic redevelopment even better. And that's where we need to go.
Okay,
another
question?
I just had a question about Mr. Mercer. I don't want to give specifics of the case, but is that unusual that it seems to me the letter is a pretty final thing, and then to have it rescinded, I would hope would be unusual.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, I do not know the circumstances of the rescission of the letter, and I had the same question. I would like to find out exactly what occurred there. There were some changes in criteria, but there is obviously an issue of fairness there, too. I have talked with Mr. Mercer in the past. I understand his frustrations with the program. We did have some severe disagreements with his consultants over the degree of risk, and you know, I absolutely respect his decision to back out of the program at this point, at that point, and wait and see until he absolutely needed to come forward. So. There are circumstances that have occurred. I can also point to issues where we've had severe criticism by developers and others who are now quite satisfied with the way that we're running the program. So it goes both ways.
Mr. Marsh, the map that you gave us, you have a number of completed sites and then a number of sites that are in the process somewhere. Is there any information that shows how long people were involved in the regulatory process before they got out the other end of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that is a really excellent question, which I have asked myself. Do we have some trend data that shows, particularly over the past 4 years since the changes were made, and since we established the timeline, internal timelines and so forth, I do not have that data today. I will keep trying to develop some, maybe initially anecdotal, but it is the kind of thing that you have an absolute right to ask, and I wish we knew exactly.
So we're talking about 182 situations here that you could easily track how much time they've been in the system, and then 267 sites that are still in the system in some stage of the process. I guess what I'm asking here is if what I hear is that you're acknowledging that you have a customer service problem, that you have a customer base that's dissatisfied with the level of service, and it's interesting to me that you haven't statistically analyzed any of the information that you have to try to figure out what the problem is and draw some conclusions from it. And I would be very interested in seeing as soon as possible how long these people were involved in your system and the ones that are still involved in it, at what point in time they came into being involved in it. And I can't see that that's going to take you an awful lot of time or energy to come up with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'll ask Paul to answer that in a second. I guess I would only differ with your statement in one respect, that I think we have some dissatisfied customers. I think we have a broad number of people who have gone through the program successfully. I agree with you that we ought to try and we will try to come up with some at least sample, statistical samples to show what kinds of time, residence time in the program people have had. One of the cautions I'd have is to find a normative set of sites, because there are often cases where people will come to us, will get into the program, will have some back and forth, and then they will decide for good business reasons to back off for a while before coming back to us and initiating activity. So results could be skewed by things that are beyond the department's
Well,
so
I would.
We'll try to find representative sites.
I would assume that over somewhere around 400 sites, you'd be able to come up with some kind of a normative number of months or years or whatever that people are involved in your system. But I would also submit to you that I'm having real problems with what appears to me to be a very logical and reasoned and fair mediation loop to be added onto your system that you're resistant to. And what I'm getting from you don't seem to be very substantial reasons against entering into this process. And that troubles me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, as I said, I believe the addition of a mediation process or opportunity to the independent claim process or even beyond it is a good idea. I think the nature of it needs to be discussed and pinned down, and I think that the reasons for our concern about this particular bill have to do with the change in the fundamental nature and philosophy of the results, as opposed to concern about not having some opportunities for an independent person to come in and help achieve a resolution. I do not believe that the appeals board that's structured in this bill is necessary to achieve that effort. At least we ought to try pilot some mediation efforts before putting into place a somewhat elaborate appeal structure, which has a number of problems for us.
Can you describe the nature of your involvement with the proponents of the bill in developing the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we have indicated our fundamental problems with this bill to the proponents from the beginning. We have put out fact sheets about the problems that we have with the bill. We are still in discussion with the proponents about how we move forward on the issues that are raised by the proponents as to why this bill is necessary. And I guess I would characterize the state of our discussions as being we still have this philosophical disagreement, if you will, about the nature of the purpose of these amendments as they affect our ability to address and the environment. I think that we also have a concern that there isn't sufficient factual basis for us to know whether this is the right way to legislate, as opposed to taking some time, stepping back, and finding out by whatever means are appropriate what are these problems that some people feel hold them back from participation.
Representative Devlin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marsh, by way of a request, unless it's somehow difficult to determine when a cleanup project begins and when it ends, I would think it would be reasonable for the committee to have information on the completed project, you know, a range, like how many were in 6 months, how many were in for a year, how many were in for 2 years, those completed, and those concurrently in status, how long they've been in status. I mean, it doesn't seem to me, given this number of projects, unless there's some problem determining when they actually begin and when they actually end, of getting that data. Because, I mean, in other committees, and they're debating with the telecommunications providers, other areas in this building over, you know, how many calls are answered within 20 seconds. So, I mean, we're only talking about 400 or 500 cases. One of the most total here is, let's see, well, a little bit over 400.
Chair Welch and Representative Devlin. Representative Devlin, you, for the record, I'm Paul Swine, the manager of the Environmental Cleanup Program. I'm the person that Director Marsh says get this information for me. It's an excellent question, unfortunately not a simple one, for the reason you just pointed out, Representative Devlin. People enter the voluntary cleanup program at different stages in the process. Some might enter at the site assessment phase, others at the remedy selection phase, and there can be extensive time in between. Nothing requires anyone to enter the voluntary cleanup program at a certain stage. So if we figure out a normative residence time, the question will be, what's normative? And you will need to tell me, or someone will need to tell me, started at this part of the voluntary cleanup process, and we can figure out a residence time. That's where it becomes challenging. Secondly, when we review a document or a set of documents, it's not King's X, so to speak. We don't say, we've reviewed this, you now have 30 days to go take action. The property owner may take as little or as much time as they need based on their own financial or business situation. So quite often, we may have a property that is very motivated, and they want to do a cleanup quickly. So once we review documents, they're right back to us. Others, maybe for various reasons, don't go ahead and affect the changes that they need to affect immediately. It's really their decision. There's no requirement that they take action within a certain time. So I'll just reiterate, while your question is an excellent one, it's not as easily calculated because of the nature of the voluntary cleanup program. They enter the cleanup program at various stages in the cleanup. I'll also quickly comment, I'm also the person that Director Marsh has said establish a mediation program or not. The real question for me and members of my staff is, what will we be mediating? And by that I mean, if we're mediating solely what comes to us through an independent cleanup, we only have that information that is before us. And that is, in effect, challenging. And so probably the strongest point we can make during mediation is we don't have enough information on which to base our decision. That's not a very strong point. And so we are establishing that process. It is a challenging establishment of a process, but it will happen. And that's the challenge with Section 2 of the Dash 4 amendments, that actually until this morning we didn't have any rulemaking authority over that. The Dash 4 amendments have rescinded the prohibition against rulemaking. But the ambiguity makes it difficult for what are we mediating, what are we discussing when we go to an appeals board. If a cap is protective, and you could argue that a cap is very protective but doesn't treat contaminated groundwater, then we live within the confines of the ambiguity of Section 2.
I need to get to this lower.
Okay.
Just one final. More of a statement than a question. I understand the philosophical objection to this bill and the way it's coming forward, but I do have a problem with the fact that it's been represented to me. And even if the department's philosophically objecting to it, it's been represented to me that the department has been unwilling to meet with proponents and talk about specific language in the bill. And that's very troubling to me. I'm taking their representation, but that's particularly troubling.
Thank you very much. And we will be back at this on Tuesday morning.
And you need to adjourn. I will close the session on the House Bill 3456.
motion to adjourn for the day.
Yeah.